Call the Joint Committee on Tax Credits to order. Welcome, everyone. We are going to start today with the first two items on our agenda. We're going to open a public hearing on both House Bill 2154 and House Bill 3168. Chris.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3168 adjusts the sunset date for two tax credits related to farm worker housing, the housing construction credit and the lender's credit. In your packet, you have, for example, the revenue impact statement. The construction credit is 50% of the eligible costs. The lender's credit is 50% of the interest income. And in the revenue impact statement, you can see that the construction credit is claimed by roughly 50 taxpayers a year, and the lender's credit is claimed by fewer than 10 credits a year, or 10 taxpayers a year. 3168 comes from the Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources on a 6-2 vote. You also have in your packet the evaluation sheet that you're familiar with by now, and also all of the testimony from the Ag Committee is also in your packet that's been provided to you. And so that bill basically just extends the sunset date to dates that are currently blank. And then House Bill 2154 makes some changes to the definitions of farm worker housing, contributing taxpayer related to the farm worker housing construction tax credit.
Okay, let's start out with Rick Crager and Lisa Joyce.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Rick Crager. I'm the Acting Director for Oregon Housing Community Services, and with me is my Policy Manager, Lisa Joyce. The Department, we've passed out some handouts here for House Bill 3168, and Chris invited me to do this via PowerPoint, but I'm kind of old-fashioned, so I'm just going to use the paper copy and walk you through our presentation here today. First of all, from the department's perspective, we are neutral on House Bill 3168. We recognize that there is a bigger tax credit discussion here, so we're here today to provide you information and hopefully provide you some of the answers to the questions that you have been provided or been asked as a committee. So starting here this morning on page 2 of our presentation, the purpose of the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit is established in ORS 456-550, and it essentially provides us this opportunity to provide safe, decent, and affordable housing to farm workers throughout the state of Oregon. One of the statistics that we provided for you in 2010, we've showed that there are about 79,000 farm workers that are in need or have unmet housing needs in the state. And since 2002, we as a department have been able to provide about 170 units per year with the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit. I should note that we as a department have had the credit in our possession since 2001. Prior to that, it was administered by another agency, but we've been able to use that credit very effectively over the last 10 years. This credit supports the development of housing for seasonal and year-long farm workers and improves the balance between farm worker jobs and available quality housing. The credit supports the construction of new housing or rehabilitation of existing housing on farms and in the community. Moving to page 3 to give you a little bit of idea of how the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit works. I think as Chris spoke, the tax credit may be taken on 50% of the eligible costs paid or incurred to complete a farm worker housing project. The eligible costs include the capital expenditures, excluding the land acquisition and routine maintenance, and the purchase and installation of manufactured housing parks. So basically, on a year, we are provided with a $3.625 million state tax credits, which equates to about $7.25 million in annual construction for farm worker housing. Owners may take the credit directly or sell the credits to investors with Oregon tax liability in exchange for capital to develop the housing, as I had mentioned. The taxpayer then may claim no more than 20% of the credit awarded in any one tax year. So again, that credit that is allocated to them on the first year. 20% of it can be used per year up to a maximum of 5 years. For each year credit is claimed, taxpayer must show the housing is continued to operate as farm worker housing, and it's eligible only for units made available to farm workers and designated in this manner for a minimum of 10 years. Moving to page 4, in terms of who directly benefits from the credit, bottom line, the result of this is creating farm worker housing for those on the farm and in community farm workers, and so ultimately they are the beneficiary of the credit itself. Farmers, growers may receive a credit to help offset the cost of building on-farm housing for their workers, and then ultimately increase their efficiency and on-the-farm production for their businesses. Also, beneficiaries are the developers of the farm worker housing and community base, and they're better able to accomplish their mission in providing safe and decent affordable housing. And then obviously from a benefit, local economies benefit from the stimulus from the housing construction itself. Page 5 asks the question, what will happen if the credit fully sunsets or is scaled down? Currently in law, it's scheduled to sunset in 2014. The reduction or sunset would ultimately reduce the number of new residents built for farm workers and a possible return to some of the unsanitary and unsafe conditions we've seen in the past. Current resources that we have obviously don't meet the ultimate need, so it's imperative that we continue to provide the farm worker housing tax credits to those that are in need. Page 6 asks the question in terms of, do other states offer a similar credit, and is a tax credit an effective and efficient way to achieve the policy goal? Currently, there are not any other states that model a farm worker housing tax credit. There are other types of grants and incentives that other states use that are different. For small on-the-farm housing projects, this particular credit is really the only thing that can be used, and it's not modeled in any other states. When the farm worker housing tax credit is a standalone source, the cost of application and the state's administrative burden are very minimal. What other incentives are available that attempt to achieve a similar policy goal? Currently, we work with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. There are other sources that are blended with the farm worker housing tax credit that make it much more possible for us to achieve the state's goals. Some of those tools include state and federal grants, and the low-income federal housing tax credit is another source that we use a great deal. Page 7 talks a little bit about the efficiency and effectiveness of the current program. We find the farm worker housing tax credit very easy to administer. It's pretty simple in terms of, we have an annual allocation of the credit that's available for both community-based partners as well as growers. It's a very effective, low overhead in terms of administering this. We depend a great deal on our partners in terms of providing that service, so we're very pleased with the efficiency of the program. Page 8 gets into a little bit of the results, and we're very happy with the production that we have been able to do. And as I mentioned earlier, since 2001, we have administered the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit. And since that time, we've had 83 developments and 1,165 units that we have produced. And just to quickly, on the very back page, actually last two pages, it gives you a little bit of a breakdown of where those developments have been. And you can see we've had good production across the state, particularly in your agricultural locations. The last page kind of gives you an idea of the community base as well as the on-farm worker and housing that we have done, and maps it out for you to give you a better idea of where the development has been. Of the 1,165 units that we have produced, 70% of those units have been community-based and 30% are on the farm. Our analysis currently shows for every dollar that we've invested in tax credit, we've had a $3.12 from other sources as leverage in capital investments and construction. And then we apply that also to our economic model that we use to show what kind of benefits that are being produced from our investments. And for every $1 that we've invested, we've been able to create $11 economic, total economic benefit. Page 9 gives you a little bit of breakdown of what that looks like with the 1,120 units. Our current leverage is about 73.3 since that time, and applying it to our economic stimulus model is about $258.1 million in total economic benefit. I should say economic stimulus. The total benefits are $331.4, and then you compare that to the cost. The farm worker housing tax credit cost is $23.4, and then we use other state and federal resources, another $14.5 million for gap funding. So that's a $37.9 million total state cost since 2001. So I think you can see from the total net benefit down at the bottom of $293.5, this has been a very successful investment that we have used over the last 10 years. Finally, Madam Chair, in summary, in terms of the program, what we see with the benefit of the farm worker housing tax credit, we are able to leverage private investment for communities and on-farm projects that may not otherwise be built. As I mentioned, the program is extremely efficient. It's very easy to administer. There's very low overhead. The credit supports the agriculture industry and strengthens communities. Again, we provide a huge economic stimulus. One, for every dollar, there's an $11 return. And then ultimately, and most importantly, it provides opportunities for farm worker housing to have safe and decent housing, and also have the ability to pay for other needs such as health care, food, clothing, and other necessities. So, Madam Chair, that concludes my presentation. I knew I'd run through that relatively quickly, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Well, first of all, your presentation here is kind of a model of what we're looking for. It's got the but-for question addressed. It's got the cost-benefit addressed, and I just, you know, send a message to others who are trying to advocate for some of these tax credits that this is the sort of information we're looking at. Not guaranteeing anything about the tax credit itself, but I'd love to guarantee all of them, believe me. What about the transferability of these credits? Are they transferable, and what is the discount rate?
Madam Chair, in terms of the credit itself, in many cases where you don't have nonprofits that are using the credit and they can't use it against a tax liability, they can sell those to other investors and be able to leverage that for returns. And then basically it's like the low-income housing tax credit model, to where you sell it off and be able to use the proceeds.
And what is the discount rate typically, and who sets it?
Basically, the way that it works right now, for all the eligible costs, you're able to take 50 cents on, or it's 50 cents credit on the actual total eligible cost.
So the buyer of the credit?
No. Yeah. I don't believe you answered the question. Yeah. I think you answered a different question, Madam.
Yeah, I'm looking for that when someone sells the credit, they sell it at a discount.
Okay.
So that the investor pays less for it.
Okay, Madam Chair.
What that is?
I think Peter might be able to help me out a little bit with that, if I may invite him up. I apologize, Madam Chair, I think I had the wrong one.
Good morning, members of the committee.
You shocked the panel. Welcome.
Madam Chair, my name is Peter Hainley. I'm Executive Director of Community and Shelter Assistance Corporation in Sherwood, Oregon. And CASA of Oregon is a nonprofit organization that works throughout the state to develop these on behalf of housing authorities, community development corporations, and other nonprofits. Your question about the discount rate, typically they're discounted. We sell them for 80 cents on the dollar, typically. Now, it varies depending on the appetite for tax credits. That amount has fluctuated over the years. It also varies on where the project is located. If it's not in an area where there's a number of banks or other investors that want to buy these, typically it could go down to 70 to 75 cents on the dollar. So it really depends on a number of factors.
Okay, thank you. And you are signed up, and you'll get a chance to testify as well. You might as well just stay there in case we have other questions. So is there a more efficient way, given the discount? How often are the credits sold versus used by the original?
Madam Chair, I believe in terms of with the farm worker credit itself, where we're typically using it for community-based housing, I'll kind of look to Peter to get the nod here on this, but typically with the community-based housing, about 70% of the time is what we're using the credit for. So those are typically where the credit is actually sold.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Peter Hanley again. So for the farmer-owned ones, we don't do a lot of on-farm housing. I do know that there are occasions where the farmers have sold those credits to others. Typically, I believe that they're using them themselves, though.
All right. Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Senator Hess.
Thank you. On this housing, who holds the deeds to these units, mm-hmm. and what happens if somebody decides to sell one of those units?
Madam Chair, Senator Hass, in terms of the deeds, these are our partners in case of the community base, which is the majority of the housing. They are the actual owners of the property. Then they are required in many cases to keep the project affordable for long term. We, as a department, are then responsible for monitoring and ensuring that affordability stays in place. If they use some of our other resources, which in many cases they are sometimes signed up for an affordability term of 60 years. So we have to make sure that they are still continuing to provide that and meet the affordability requirements for that term.
Follow up. So what are the rules? Can someone sell one of these houses?
Madam Chair, Senator Hass, there can be transfers. There could be they could ultimately sell the housing, particularly in community base, and then they have to. The new owner has to first of all, the transaction has to be approved by the department, and then they have to meet the same requirements for the period of the affordability.
May I? Peter Hanley again with CASA. Typically on the community-based, you're going to have U.S. Department of Agriculture with a 33-year loan, so there's not going to be any transfer. In the occasions where this has been used for like a single-family home for farm workers that has perhaps been owned by a nonprofit with a subsequent resale under some land, some lease purchase option. Typically, there's other funds in there that are going to have some sort of long-term commitment to remain as affordable or remain as farm worker housing. If it's on the farm housing, you're typically talking about a house that's on a big parcel of land. It's not going to be sold off.
Follow up, please. But farms do sell. Farms bought sold all the time. So what happens if you have these units on a farm? The farmer decides to do something else and sells his farm, then what does he profit from these homes, or how are those homes that are built on that property which is being sold dealt with?
Madam Chair, Senator Hass, land use law really restricts the use of on-farm housing, and you're getting into an area that gets very complicated. For folks that are working on the farm, they have to work a certain number of years if they're going to live there, or they have to work a certain number of months if they're going to live there year-round. If it's temporary housing on farm, then there's a whole nother set of land use laws that applies to that. So I understand your question, but it's really difficult to separate the land use question here from your question. So
follow up, please. It may be difficult, but that happens, right? That a farm can be sold with these housing units on it?
Madam Chair, Senator Hass, yes, that has happened. As far as what the units are then subsequently used for, I would not know. I do know, 70% of the money is going to community-based, which has very strict restrictions on it. So on the money that is going to on-farm housing, while there is periodic review, typically by OSHA, for habitability and safety standards, that's a whole different thing than I think the question that you're asking.
Thank you.
Thank you. Rip Simmons, Bernhardt.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you get us the background and the bases for the material on page 9? What you have here, of course, is a summary, and it would be useful to understand how you derived those numbers and what your assumptions were as you developed them.
Madam Chair, Senator Representative Barnhart, we'd be happy to provide you that. It gets into a real detailed, complex formula, but we're happy to provide. We just wanted to give you the summary results.
But this is the WONT committee.
Yeah.
So this is what we do.
Happy to provide that.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know quite how to derive this, but clearly these community-based or even the on-farm ones are put together with a combination of financing and government.
Right.
I'm trying to get at a sense of how important this piece is compared to the other pieces of subsidies and credits that go into a typical community-based project, and how big is a community-based project? I have a series of questions, Madam Chair, in terms of units, because you've got things broken down two ways here, number of developments and number of housing units. And so these are kind of apples and oranges to those of us who are on this wonkish committee.
Right. Madam Chair, Representative Berger, in terms of the type of housing that we provide, again, the community base, you're absolutely right that it is a complex mixture of different sources, and we can provide you a little bit more breakdown on those community base in terms of what sources go into it. I would say that, you know, our experience has been that, and as you can see from the model, that the farm worker housing development piece is a critical component to what we do, and when you look at all the units, about $23.4 million is the total cost that is covered with the farm worker housing tax credit. There are other sources, the $14.5 million, and typically those are some of your more flexible sources, such as our Housing Development Trust Fund is a piece that isn't, you know, where there are other costs that need to be covered.
You're just talking about state resources. You're not including federal, which would be a...
Yeah, and Madam Chair, there is, and Representative Berger, there is the federal resources that go to that as well.
Yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's a good question, because in a number of these communities, Irrigan, we have a 8-unit project which uses federal resources and has a little small amount of farm worker tax credits in it. That was in a long time ago, before the feds were really requiring you to show up front that you have the leverage. So this funding source is crucial for us to be able to secure those funds from the feds. In 2010, we had two projects that were funded by the feds for a total of about $6 million. And if we hadn't have had that farm worker tax credit in there as leverage, we wouldn't have scored high enough to be able to have accessed those funds. So it's really huge.
One more question, Madam Chair, if you'll indulge me.
As many as you want.
On your list on page 11, would it be possible for you to break down these developments by the year they were completed and just send it as a spreadsheet?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, happy to do that.
Thank you.
Be an easy deal.
Okay. Other questions? Yes. Representative Brewer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 3 of your slide, it said, for each year the credit is claimed, taxpayer must show the housing is operated as farm worker housing. I'm asking clarification of what claimed means. Does that mean in the year generated in one of the first initial 5 years, or does that also mean application of the carry-forward period? And if you could put that in context of if the credit is sold, for Senator Haas's concerns, once the credit is transferred, and the investor or purchaser of the credit, how do they go about demonstrating that it still uses farm worker housing?
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Ira Brewer, what we do from the department standpoint is once the credit is awarded, then there is an agreement that is signed with the owner of the property. We're then responsible to ensure that project remains affordable and is continuing to serve the population that was intended. So, as I mentioned, it could be a minimum of the 10 years, but in most cases, and like Peter had alluded to, there is a longer term in which we have to ensure that's affordable, and they have to provide us the information to ensure. The credit itself then actually can be claimed. It's 20% of it each and every year. For a period of five years, I believe, is the total in which it can be claimed for. Is that correct, Peter?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, up to 10 years.
Up to 10.
But you can do it in as short as 5. And there is an annual certification that the tax credit, the person using the tax credit has to file with the Department of Revenue. So I don't know if that addresses Senator Hass's question about the need for being able to follow up on it. But if there is a transfer of ownership, hopefully you would see it by them either not having filed that or having a new owner had filed for it.
So, you want to follow up?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So even if the credit is transferred, an annual certification is still required by the taxpayer claiming the credit on their return, even in a carry-forward period.
Correct.
When the credit is carried forward. Okay, thank you.
And the remedy, if someone does fall off of the program requirements, the remedy is just to disallow what's remaining on the tax credit, or do you have any kind of
Madam Chair, they wouldn't be eligible for the credit anymore. The credit, that would stop.
But there's no way of going back and retrieving the parts of the credit that have already been used, correct?
Madam Chair, no.
But if you had, if the credit weren't transferred, like in, if it weren't transferred, like on these farm, on-farm housing, then theoretically you could have a clawback provision, couldn't you?
Madam Chair, I'd have to look at that, but I believe you would be able to then.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. And now, Mr. Haynes, you get to say what you originally
okay,
wanted to
I think
to
I've
say.
Covered half of it. My name is Peter Hanley, Community and Shelter Assistance Corporation in Sherwood, Oregon. We're a 501c3 nonprofit that works with local organizations and local communities to develop housing and related services for farm workers and other rural communities. And since about 1988, we've created approximately 1,100 units of housing in community. And we've also done a number of projects in conjunction with farmers to rehabilitate their on-farm. And I might mention that the numbers there of units may be a little misleading because oftentimes those units represent many bed spaces in one unit for the on-farm. The units for the community base would obviously be units, but just so you know that those numbers might be a little misleading. I also apologize. I left Senator Burdick's name off on the letter, so apologize.
Thank you for pointing that out. I didn't notice.
I got two of the B's, but I missed the third one. So one other thing I might mention is that this credit started in 1989 and was under the auspices of OSHA. They administered this program for a number of years. And so the information you see here is since OHCS has run the program. So, you know, there's an additional approximately 400 to 500 community-based projects, and I don't know how many on-farm projects that are not included in their information or on this map, and we've been trying to get that information for OSHA, but it's in the archive somewhere and have not yet retrieved it. So, you've had a number of communities that have taken advantage of this tax credit. For an example, in Independence, there was a project that was completed in 2006, 40 units, where we were able to leverage about $6 million in private and other funds. We had a project that we did in Rockwood where we leveraged about $2 million in USDA. We've got projects that we've done in, like I said, Ontario, Hermiston, Irrigan, many out in Washington County. Throughout the state, we've probably leveraged about $80 million in private and other federal funds as well as some local and state funding. I'm going to be brief since, you know, we're the ones that are really selling the credits on behalf of the local organizations that we work with. So as far as technical issues, I would just end by saying that if you have any questions, I'd be prepared to answer them.
Do you have an opinion on how it would affect the on-farm housing if we did have a clawback provision? Addressing some of Senator Hass's concerns.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm very supportive of on-farm housing. Typically, we do mostly community-based. There's a lot of areas where it's hard to develop community-based housing. We have a lot of grower support, and if there was to be a clawback provision, I think it would have to be very carefully crafted. I really don't think that it's a problem out there. I mean, I don't think many of the folks that have used this, and we're talking Hood River County, where probably the majority of these have happened, I don't think they're renting them out as, summer homes or anything else. I mean, truly, they have a need for this type of housing. So I don't think you're going to see much fraud in the way, perhaps there could be an occasional visit by the department out to these projects to make sure, during growing season. That might be one way to make sure. But I just don't see that as a real issue.
Okay, thank you. Questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Morris.
This is a little bit tangential, but I think it maybe gets to some of the issues raised by Senator Hast. I see that the bill expands the application to manufactured housing.
Yeah.
And then looking at the definition of manufactured housing, it's limited to a cooperative purchase, a nonprofit cooperative. Is that correct?
Senator Morris, members of the committee, yes, that is correct.
And in that event, the statute reads, limits the use of all income and earnings to use by the cooperative and not for the benefit or profit of any individual. So in terms of what happens, maybe there's a follow-on question here.
Yeah.
When you have that occasion that is owned by the cooperative and the property is then sold, the proceeds still reside with the cooperative.
Senator Morris, members of the committee, let me back up a little bit and explain why we are requesting this. We recently formed a co-op in McMinnville that was made up almost entirely of farm workers. And as I've been working in this industry for 18 years, we've noticed that farm workers live in manufactured housing parks in rural areas. There's a lot of them living in manufactured housing parks. And so what we wanted to do was, where we have a park where we can form a nonprofit co-op, and the members of the co-op then are paying their lease space to the co-op, then we would be able to use the farm worker tax credit to change out a lot of these pre-76 very energy inefficient units. And so the idea is that we would be able to use the tax credits to upgrade some of those units, or even if there was an opportunity to do a new park where we wanted farm workers to form or where farm workers wanted to form a co-op and make a new manufactured housing park, we could then use the units for that purpose. So that's the reasoning of why we wanted to use the tax credits for the parks where there would be farm workers living there.
And just for the record, we have the hearing open on both 3168 and 2154, so your last round of questions and comments were applying to House Bill 2154, which is more of the details of this program. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is really a follow-up. For the co-ops you're describing, is it contemplated that they would own the land that the facility is on?
Representative Barnhart, members of the committee, that is correct.
Representative Berger.
Am I understanding that the thrust of the manufactured home piece is most specifically to a particular project in McMinnville?
Representative Berger, no, that's not correct. I was trying to line it up of what we found as we were working on this project in McMinnville was when we first went into it, it was a park that was closing. Everybody was going to be displaced. When we went in there to start working on it, we realized that a lot of these units couldn't be moved because we had to do some infrastructure repair. So we ended up having to find new homes to bring in. And what we would like to do is be able to bring in some new homes that are energy efficient. We weren't able to bring in new homes. We were able to find some secondhand homes that weren't quite energy efficient. We were able to find some ODOT homes that because of the bypass. So it's not for one particular project. What we'd like to do is be able to, when we have a park that is going to be occupied by farm workers, that we would be able to use the tax credit for that purposes. So it's looking prospectively. It's not looking at any particular park.
follow-up?
Yes, so this has not really been done before. This is sort of a new direction, this using old manufactured home parks.
I just wanted, Lisa Joyce, Policy and Communication Manager. The reason that we have explicitly called out the manufactured dwelling park cooperatives in statute is that the tax credit itself is restricted, as it's currently written. People who live in the housing or own the housing can't benefit directly from the credit. This would allow the cooperative to make that purchase and benefit from the credit.
In this McMinnville project, are you also applying for Conservation Betsy credits?
No. No, we did not apply for Conservation credits.
Thank you.
All right. Other questions from the committee?
He could.
We really are wonks. Okay. Thank you very much.
Should we have applied?
Would you like me to speak to 2154?
Yes. We had them both open, so I thought you were going to.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Joyce again. I'm here today to ask for your support for 2154A. Unlike 3168, where we are neutral, this is a bill that the department brought forward to address some issues that we've identified in our application of the Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit. Excuse me. The existing Farm Worker Housing Tax Credit statutes make it hard for us to use the credit in conjunction with other funding sources and also limit us to certain kinds of farm work. And the changing nature of farm work requires us to update these statutes. The bill will update the definition of farm work, allow manufactured dwelling park cooperatives that include farm workers to use the credits to purchase a manufactured dwelling park, as we addressed before. 2154 expands the definition of farm worker so that lower-income Oregonians engaged in agricultural and aquacultural work, including processing on the farm, can obtain decent and affordable housing. It also brings state definitions into line with other programs that support the development of housing for agricultural workers. Another key change is that it will allow retired or disabled farm workers to continue to live in community-based housing development financed with the credit, as does the federal definition. The new provisions of 2154A apply to community-based housing and leave the existing provisions for on-farm housing intact. There was some concern when we were in the House committee that farmers would be required to provide ongoing housing to retired farm workers, and that is not the case with this. The use of exclusive farm use will remain intact. The proposed legislation revises a definition. Clarifies that owners may sell farm worker housing tax credits to a contributor in return for an equity investment in the property. Over the term of the credit, provide opportunity for creditor without tax liability to transfer the credit to another contributor one time only after the project's completion. Clarifies that the department may allocate credits to housing developments on a pro rata basis to reflect the number of units in the development that are dedicated to farm workers. We may have those community-based settings where just a few of the units are for serving farm workers, and right now we're not able to use the credit to finance those projects. Clarifies language on the application form, if you want to get really wonky. Clarifies the application process and the period during which the owners can apply for credits. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the definition section of this proposal, and I'm getting back to it now. On page 2, I think, where it changes the definition of a farm worker. Any person who, for an agreed remuneration or rate of pay, performs temporary permanent labor for another in the, sub B, capital B on line 2, handling of agriculture or aquaculture products or products at an unprocessed stage, and C, processing of agricultural or aquaculture products, crops or products. The question is, would then a farm worker include someone who worked temporarily for an agricultural processing plant, but not on a farm?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It would. It doesn't now, does it?
No.
And may I follow up?
Please.
Why do you want that change?
Representative Barnhart, we're working on a project in Boardman, and as we have, it's been in the process for about 5 years, and we were originally looking to try and serve the farm workers up at Three Mile Canyon, and we figured we maybe needed to broaden it. The feds had recently changed their farm worker definition to include processing workers, and we just felt that now was the time to come forward and try and include processing workers so that it coincides with the federal definition, so that it wouldn't just be the processing plants at the Port of Morrow, but it would be the oyster farmers, it would be the processors, which are basically people that are earning about the same rate of pay as a typical farm worker. So it was broadening the group of folks that we could serve, yet really serving at a very similar income level.
Follow up,
please.
Thank you. Then small b on line 8 of the same page. Any other person whom the Housing and Community Services Department defines by rule as a farm worker. What are the sideboards on that allowance? What are the things in law that you could not include then, or people you could not include then in farm worker? I mean, my guess is it would apply to everyone if you decided to by rule.
If we decided to by rule. The purpose of this is that we won't have to come back every time the federal government changes its scope of programs. We would be able to sync up with them more easily.
So if we rewrote this particular rule to say that it's limited, that your rule is limited to the changes that would comply with current federal statute, that would be acceptable?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess the question is, how much does rent factor into this? I've just been assuming the rent would be low or maybe no rent, but how does that which the builder of the facility get paid for building it, how does that factor into your analysis of these units?
Representative Bentz, members of the committee, if I get your question correctly, I sense two questions in there.
At least.
Okay. I'll go to the rent question for the farm workers. If it is a USDA project, rural development, rents are restricted to 30% of income. So there's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. The feds define what the rents are. They oftentimes provide a rental assistance subsidy that will help if they need to make up the difference between what the charged rents are and what that 30% figure is. So that's that. The same thing happens when you use these tax credits with the low-income housing tax credits. The department sets specific rental income limits and specific rents tied to those income limits. So, you know, in both cases, as far as rents are charged, that should be taken care of. Now, on the on-farm, that's another piece. There's nothing in statute that says there's certain limits. Most farmers that I know don't charge anything. So unless you were following the case in Southern Oregon where Bear Creek just did not prevail in their suit, and that's a whole other thing, but that I believe didn't have farm worker tax credits. That was a lawsuit that farm workers were being charged by Bear Creek as part, it was being deducted from their rent, I mean from their salary. So, and then you had another question in there about construction, and I'm not quite sure I caught how that one related.
Actually, what I was trying to learn is if I wanted to go build some of this housing, how much could I make as an investor, shall we say, by utilizing all the credits that are available and then charging as much rent as I possibly could to these folks that are supposed to be benefited by this device. That's what I'm really trying to get at.
Oh, okay. Representative Bentz, members of the committee, I guess you could, the department could evaluate it, and I just don't see how you get 50% of the cost of construction, so you could get a pretty big chunk of the change through them. And let's say you got deep pockets and you could pay for the rest of it yourself, you still have to prove to them that you're going to build housing that's going to be affordable to farm workers. So the rents, you can't just go in and say, I'm going to charge take this free money, charge the highest rents. they got to evaluate it and make sure that it's affordable to the farm workers in your area. I mean, if I was to take an example of a project we did in Ontario, Sierra Vista Apartments, this was a key question because we had low-income housing tax credits and farm worker tax credits and the Oregon affordable housing tax credits all tied up, and we knew there was a lot of farm workers in that area, but we still didn't get the rents low enough to really be able to serve them on an ongoing basis. And so there for a period of time, there was a high number of vacancies. Now it's filled, but it's a real issue. So I appreciate the question, but I really think they've done a good job as far as making sure the rents are controlled.
And Madam Chair, Representative Benson, just to add to that, again, and I echo what Peter said, I mean, we have to ensure that these projects are financially feasible. That's what we do. That's what our underwriting piece is. And those rents have to be affordable. If not, they don't work and we don't allocate the credits.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to maybe direct our conversation just a bit to the efficiency of the tax credit versus a direct grant. And two questions, one for our legislative revenue staff. Do we have the ability to change from a tax credit to a grant under the relating clause of this bill or in future bills that may come to us?
Senator Morse.
I'm trying to find the bill. I believe the relating to clause is just related to the tax credit, but there are other vehicles that could be used to convert it to a grant.
A follow-up question. If we were on a grant basis, are there any federal funds that could be matched to expand the benefit?
Madam Chair, Senator Morse, I think that certainly there's none that I'm aware of right off the top of my head in terms of any type of taking the general fund is what we're talking about here as opposed to a tax credit and being able to match. I think that there, most of the programs that we have now where we're working with the federal government, we're already maximizing as much as we can. Certainly there could be other opportunities. Grant money, especially state grant money, is always much more attractive because it could bring in other federal resources, but I'm not aware of anything off the top of my head. Are you aware of any other federal dollars out there matching?
Yeah, Senator Morris, members of the committee, I'm not sure that it would expand our opportunities on the federal side of things. I mean, one of the beauties of this thing is that it's very simple, and for good or for bad, we are selling them to banks a lot of times, a lot of community banks and regional banks. And it induces them oftentimes to make loans to these projects. It helps them meet their CRA credits, which is important for them and for us. So it does have those corollary benefits to it. And one of the other things is that the banks don't have to take an ownership interest in it, which makes it a lot easier for dealing with them. So, getting a grant from a bank, albeit it is discounted, or getting a grant from the state government, which is going to come with additional strings attached and the need for more administrative than this program typically. I'm not sure if you can get to more efficiencies through a direct grant program. Possibly, but I'm just not sure.
The idea of giving up 30% in some markets is a little troublesome.
Senator Morse, I agree. But also, if we were to identify what those administrative costs would be, the difficulty of perhaps inducing a bank or an investor to then join with us to develop this housing in some of these rural areas, I can't answer your question definitively. It's a very good point. But I think that given the history that we've had and going forward, we've got some pretty good opportunities to continue doing some great work out there. So, but I hear you.
So I'm hearing you saying that the tax credit itself encourages the banks who are using the tax credit to also invest?
Madam Chair, that is correct. It's there a lot of times. They see a benefit into having to investing in these tax credits, as well as then making either a loan of a construction loan or a permanent loan on the project. If it's in a rural area and it's in their service area, then there's also the CRA benefits that goes with it, too.
What is CRA?
I'm sorry, I shouldn't speak in Community Reinvestment Act. So it's a 35, 40-year-old federal government regulations that banks must invest in the communities where they serve. So it's, you know, some of the banks hate it. Some of them love it. Some of them do a really good job making sure that they meet the requirements of that. Our position is that it makes good business sense if we're going to go seek a loan from them. And if you looked at, and I'm getting off a little bit, but the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit is another credit that we're working with that is run primarily through a nonprofit called Network for Oregon Affordable Housing, of which I'm on the board. And those loans are paid like clockwork. These are well-designed projects. They're well-run. They're well-regulated both by the investors, by the banks that make the loan, in this case NOAA, as well as the state and their asset and property management division.
Okay. Thank you. More questions?
One last question. The 50% cost of construction that was mentioned, who's paying that? Explain that to me.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to take you back in time. In 1999, the legislature formed an interim task force, which Senator, it's Representative Mannix and Senator Castillo chaired. And at the time, it was a 30% of construction, and we weren't getting the federal funds like we really wanted to get them. And so the task force came up with 18 recommendations, which they put out a report in 2000, which then in the 2001 legislature, they increased it from 30% of the eligible basis, which is basically most of the costs excluding land, increased it from 30 to 50%. So you could take, let's say you have a $1 million project, and I'm leaving land out of it, construction, 50% or $500,000 would be eligible to secure the tax credits with, okay?
Okay.
So you can't, you couldn't, you know, in the earlier, in Representative Bence's earlier, you know, if I wanted to get some money to build this and charge high rents, well, you can only get a certain portion of it funded through these tax credits. Okay.
And Madam Chair, Representative Berger, I think you asked the question, who incurs that cost? Whose is it? That's essentially the cost of the developer. So to Peter's point, you have a $1 million project. That's the cost that they incur. However, in return, they can get a credit for 50% of those eligible costs.
Right. So to take the example further, if we're going to use the 30% discount rate, so $500,000, it's going to be $150,000. They're going to contribute $350,000, okay? And they're going to get a $500,000 tax credit over a five-year period.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much. We have one more witness, and then we'll close this hearing. Our next witness is John McCulley, who wants to talk about House Bill 3168, but you're free to talk about the other one, too.
Madam Chair, would it be all right if I come?
No. Yes.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John McCulley. I'm here representing the tree fruit growers, primarily the apple, pear, and cherry growers in the Mid-Columbia. And you've noticed on your handout the number of projects that are done in Hood River and Wasco counties. And as you might imagine, the growers that I represent are very supportive of this tax credit program and have used it effectively to rehabilitate and construct new housing for farm workers in that area. We believe that the program has done exactly as it's intended to do, provide an incentive to have someone do something they wouldn't normally do, and that, in this case, construct farm worker housing. As you heard from previous witnesses, the housing that's constructed on the farm generally is provided at no cost to the farm workers who live there. It is a benefit to the grower, there's no question, to have that ready availability of labor to harvest, to prune, to perform other tasks in the orchards of the people that that I represent. We believe it has been a very effective program. June normally is features headlines of deplorable housing conditions as the strawberry farmers and strawberry workers begin to come to Oregon. We haven't seen those headlines for many years. And that is a result of, I believe, the effectiveness of this tax credit program and, truthfully, enhanced enforcement from OROSHA. To qualify for this tax credit, the housing must be inspected by OROSHA. If it is run as farm worker housing, or OSHA licenses that housing and thus makes it subject to inspection. So there is significant regulatory oversight of the producers who utilize this housing. We encourage you to move forward with this bill. We think it is critical to the agriculture community to have this credit available to construct housing, attract workers who can harvest the crops that we produce. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome.
Co-Chair Burdick and Bailey, for the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. I'd like to echo Mr. McCulley's comments this morning. It is critically important for those producers who do find the opportunity through the tax credit to provide really what ends up being a policy objective of the state to provide housing at low income or at low cost for the farm worker. On farm, recall that agriculture is seasonal, so the work that's performed is somewhat time intensive and limited in duration. So, providing an opportunity for the farm worker to be on farm during those periods that there is a tremendous amount of work to be performed is a great benefit for not only the farmer but the farm worker, as those that work is being performed. The Farm Bureau supports both House Bill 3168 and 2154, and we would encourage the committee to move forward with extending these tax credits.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. I really appreciate your bringing up the issue of time. Limited and time-intensive, I think you said. Can you give us an idea what we're talking about in terms of weeks per year that these dwellings on the farms are actually occupied?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, I'll try. One example would be cherry harvest in Wasco County in the Dalles. The housing would normally be occupied probably from June to mid-July. There are developing different varieties of cherries to extend that harvest season, but generally I would say 6 to 8 weeks would be the maximum there. For the pear harvest in the Hood River area, it might be a little longer because of the different varieties of pears that are harvested. So Bartlett harvest maybe starting in September, finishing with the Anjos later. It might be an extension of another 30 days beyond that. Sometimes the housing is occupied longer for crews that may stay through harvest and then stay and do pruning during the winter. But for the most part, that housing is not occupied more than 6 months and then only by a small number of people.
That's interesting.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Other question?
One more question. Gentlemen, what we've seen on the farm is an incredible amount of mechanization, so the actual number of farm laborers, has it decreased? I guess I'm asking in terms of production and hand work. What I've seen is an incredible decrease in the actual hand work farm labor, and as a result, some of these farm laborers aren't laborers at all. They have to know how to use very sophisticated mechanized equipment. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Berger, yes, you are correct. It has not been seen as much in the fruit industry as it has in other parts of agriculture. Sometimes for processing fruit, mechanization can work, but pears have to be hand removed from the tree. They are working on technology
to mechanize that, but they haven't reached the point yet where a machine can replace a human pulling that pear from the tree. Oregon is known, of course, for its fresh cherries, and those fresh cherries cannot be mechanically harvested. They all have to be hand harvested. So at least in that industry, mechanization has not achieved the harvest. There are some efficiencies in platforms moving through the field to make it easier for workers to harvest so they don't have to be up and down on ladders. But nonetheless, it's still all hand harvest.
And Representative Berger, I'd like to follow up. One thing that the Farm Bureau has seen statewide is a decline on on-farm housing, and I would say that that is more of a reaction to some of the administrative burdens from the producer's perspective of making sure that the floor space is compliant with the amount of window space and updating to some of the federal regs. So just from a regulatory perspective, I think many producers have stopped providing those housing, but in the Hood River area, the Dalles and such, where those commodities do require that skill labor, there is still a tremendous need.
Thank you.
Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question I intended to ask everyone, and somehow I've managed to not get there. How will the legislature know when this credit is, these credits are no longer needed? How will we... What will be the basis for us being able to say, okay, we started this in the late 80s. We don't need it anymore. Let's end it.
You take it, Sean.
Well, I think quite simply the utilization of the credit is probably the key indicator of need. However, I will say that over the past 4 years, because of some of the federal regulations and the requirement to update bedding, floor space in ratio to windows, as I mentioned, some of the facilities, dishwashers, cook stoves, those regulations that require updating the facilities has provided a new need for the tax credit. So I guess if the federal government and the state government were to no longer pass mandates, the only need would be determined by whether the producer would be interested in providing that as a service to his employees.
Follow up, yes. What I'm really asking is that, and by the way, I do appreciate the response, especially the last part of it. I'm sure that's a part of the issue. But what I'm really asking is a different way of saying asking the but-for question. Clearly, if I were going to go out and build something and a government was going to pay me half of the cost of doing it, whether I could make a profit without the government paying half the cost or not, I would certainly take the credit, wouldn't I? Even if I could have managed it without that. But as long as I qualify, I'm going to take it. So the question is not, it seems to me, and answering the question by saying, well, there's still a demand for the credit, doesn't really get to what we're trying to get at all. The answer, it seems to me, has to be connected with the but-for question. That is, if it weren't for this, there wouldn't be this kind of housing being done, and we need this kind of housing. Those two things have to go together, it seems to me. And that's what I really intend to ask when I ask, how will we know when the credit's no longer needed?
Madam Chair, Representative Barnhart, I guess one of the things that I wanted
you
to
identify yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Again, Rick Krager, Acting Director for Oregon Housing Community Services. One of the things that I wanted to bring up in response to Representative Barnhart's question, which is a very good one, for all of our housing, one of the things that we have designed as a department is what's called the housing needs model. And what it does is it provides an analysis of community by community what are kind of the highest priority needs within each county. And this is to ensure that we're making the investments towards those highest needs. Now, I don't have the specifics for you, but I'll be happy to provide that to you.
Correct answer.
But what I can say to you is that In most cases, particularly in Hood River and Wasco County, you're seeing the highest needs that is coming up. I mean, basically, it's comparing the farm worker housing population that we have versus the number of units that are made available to that particular population. When you compare that against all the other special needs, many cases, it's coming up to be the highest priority each and every case. So that is the model that helps us drive those investments that we make as a state agency. Again, Representative Barnhart, I'm sorry I don't have all those specifics, but I can bring that to you, and I want you to know that that helps drive Oregon Housing Community Services investments throughout the state.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
If you have any comparison between activity building housing when you had the 30% credit versus the 50% credit, do you have that data?
Senator Burdick, certainly I'll look back and keep in mind that we took on the credit in 2001 when much of the law was changed to 50%. So our experience has been using it that way. We'd have to kind of dive in and look at some of the housing units that were financed not through us, but we can look at that. I'm not positive that I can get that information for you, but I certainly will try.
Okay, thank you. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, anybody else want to talk on this one, these two bills? Okay, we'll close the public hearings on House Bill 3174 and 2154.
Oops, 3168.
I'm sorry, 3168. And we will actually open a public hearing on House Bill 3174.
Madam Chair, members of the committees, House Bill 3174 adjusts the sunset date for the tax credit for qualified research activities. Since 2005, about 200 taxpayers have claimed the credit each year, and the credit, it's kind of a dual structure. The credit is 5% of research expenses exceeding a base amount up to $2 million per year, and an alternative structure is based on expenses that exceed 10% of Oregon sales. The bill comes to you from the Transportation and Economic Development Committee, where it passed out 6-2. And again, you have the evaluation sheet and the testimony that was provided in that committee. And one thing I did want to point about the revenue impact is I've gotten some questions on this. In 1113, by extending the sunset date, I have a revenue impact of about $2 million for 1113, and then it ramps up pretty quickly to about $12 million in 2015-17. This is one of the credits that has, over the past several years, usage of the credit has averaged around 12 or 13%. In the most recent year, in 2008, only about 10% of the credit claimed was used. There were about $60 million claimed on the corporate tax returns, but only $6 million was actually used to reduce liability. And we have to go back to about 2000 before the usage of the credit really ramped up. In 2000, it was about 40% of the amount claimed was used. But since then, it's really dropped off. In 2000, I believe it was 2005, the amount of the credit increased from $750,000 to $2 million. And there have been a number of factors this past decade. You have the recession the first part of the decade, and then as the credit was being increased to $2 million, the state was also moving to a single sales factor. So there have been a number of policies that have kind of overlapped. So I believe those are the drivers for why the usage of the credit is pretty low. Now, the revenue impact, so trying to understand that a little bit, I've been looking at people who claim it, and there are kind of two groups. Every year there are a couple $1 million in people and kind of the smaller businesses that claim it and are able to use it, the kind of new claimants every year, and that accounts for that $2 million impact. And with the carry forward, with the large amount that is sitting out there unused, before the revenue impact really picks up, all those carry forwards would have to be used up. And that's why as we go out a couple of biennia, the revenue impact starts to increase then, because right away when it goes away, if somebody has a lot of unused credits on their books, they can still claim those for a couple of years before their credits will be used up. So that explains the pattern of the revenue impact.
And Chris, how long do they have to carry forward these credits?
Madam Chair, I believe it's a 5-year carry forward.
And can you, for our listening audience who is hanging on every word of this hearing, can you talk about the interaction of the single sales factor and this credit?
Well, the single sales factor, we went to a super sales factor in the mid in several years ago, and then it had ramped up to a single sales factor. And that really shifted the burden of who actually pays the corporate tax. And exporters, the shift there, if you have a large export base, your tax liability went down because you didn't have a lot of Oregon sales. And so a lot of the companies, the bigger companies, I mean, the companies that claim this will be smaller to large, so it's a number of different size companies. The larger corporations have a lot of external sales, so with the single sales factor, that will drive down their liability, and then they actually can't use some of the credits because of the overlapping policies.
So, for example, a company like Intel, before and after the single sales factor, before the single sales factor was adopted, they would have more use of this credit than they do now. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, theoretically, I'm not trying to be evasive. I just don't want to commit a C felony.
Well, Madam Chair,
I'm in a company like Intel, which has a lot of out-of-state sales, or Company X with a lot of out-of-state sales before and after the single sales factor went in.
Right. If you have a large company and they export a lot of products, and then prior to the single sales factor, we can go back, we had a double-weighted sales factor. Mm-hmm. And then as we move to a single sales factor, if they have large exports, that will reduce their liability because the liability then focuses on the sales in state.
Right. Would you want to say something?
Well, I was going to follow up on the same theme but a slightly different basis. You indicated that there are two bases for the claim. One is 5% of R&D costs over a base amount, and the other was based on cost based on 10% of Oregon sales. I wonder if the change from the old bases for corporate taxation to the current one has changed the way in which those two rules apply. It would seem to me that if the 10% of Oregon sales rule applied before the rule change, then that amount, of course, is a lot smaller, and therefore the floor would be a lot smaller.
Representative Barnhart, I believe you're correct in the basis there. From looking at the tax returns, they're not separately listed, so I can't look at them separately and look at how they've played out over the years. To get at that information, it would be there, but it would involve a lot of very extensive legwork in pulling corporate tax returns and seeing exactly which basis they used.
Okay, maybe could I just follow up on that topic then. Could you explain in a bit more detail what these requirements are? When can a company claim an R&D credit? And you've given us two bases, but you went by them really fast. Can you back up and give us a bit more detail?
Sure. The research expense, there's a base year for which they set their level of research R&D level. And expenses above that base year would be 5% of the R&D expenses above that base year would be subject to the credit. And I believe it's a similar structure for the sales.
And how's the base year established?
I would have to do a little more research to figure out the detail on that one.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it.
Okay. I think we'll move into our hearing. Just so people are aware of our time situation here, the House, I understand, goes on the floor at 10:15 today. So we will be completing our work by then. And so I want to start off our panels with the people who are not normally in the building. And so I'll start out with Mark Modjeski, Donna Reagan, and we'll bring up Greg Miller with that panel.
Welcome.
Whoever wants to start.
It's okay, guys. Good morning, Madam Chair, Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is Greg Miller with PacWest Communications, here today representing the Smart Growth Coalition. I would first like to thank Representative Bintz and Representative Reed for advancing this bill out of their committee so we could further this discussion here. We appreciate that. Testimony I've handed out today focuses on Oregon as an incubator for research and development type of activities. Talk specifically about the dollar amounts that are invested in wages, reinvested into the communities, reinvested into the state of Oregon, across a broad sector of industries, not just your high tech, but clean tech, manufacturing, tried to look at some agriculture. The other thing I've focused on is patents, where Oregon ranks with patents. I won't belabor the testimony that I've provided to you. I do have Mark Majeski, who's a member of the Smart Growth Coalition, down here this morning, and would defer to him to talk about some of the details of the tax credit. But just to simply state on the record that Smart Growth Coalition does support an extension of this tax credit.
Okay, Mr. Majeski.
Mark Majeski here. I'm the tax director at Tektronix. Pleasure to be here, address the committee. I usually come down here, it seems like, once every 2 years to address something in taxation, so I this is my something, so thank you. Obviously, we're here in support of extending the sunset date for the Oregon Research Credit. Probably many of you know something about Tektronix. We've been in business here in Oregon for 65 years. We manufacture, sell, and service precision test measurement and monitoring equipment that enables our customers to deploy next-generation technologies. We do most of that work today at our Oregon campus, which is the Howard Vollum campus in Beaverton. That's our headquarters campus. That's where most of our technology is occurring today. In November of 07, Tektronix was acquired by Danaher Corporation, and today we join in the filing of a consolidated Oregon corporate income tax return with other Danaher affiliates that are organized around the country. Our customers are worldwide. We do a lot of work in the semiconductor industry. Intel's a good customer. In fact, Intel came to Oregon in 1974 at the request of Tektronix, so we're glad they're here. We do have many other customers in the telecommunications industry, consumer electronics, military aerospace, education, and many other industries. We started off as an engineering company in 1946. And we continue to be predominantly an engineering company today. Many of the folks that work on the Beaverton campus are in the engineering groups. Many of those folks hold advanced degrees in electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, math and physics. It's a pretty bright and eclectic group. Our tagline today is we enable innovation. More than 65% of our annual revenues are derived from products that have been introduced into the market within the last 3 years. We call that our vitality index. We invest 12 to 18% of our worldwide sales in R&D. And quite simply, if we did not continue to invest in R&D to that extent, we would no longer be a viable business. Our competitors would take over our customer base. I know you folks are interested in data, so I've provided some in the back of my written testimony. Some of the information I wanted to give you today is company confidential, but this information I can release. We have between 400 and 500 employees at the Howard Vollum campus in Beaverton. Full-time employees who are engaged in qualified research activities. Most of those are the engineers that I was referring to previously. We also use several contractors here in Oregon to perform engineering design services. The average pay of the full-time employees, if you look at total compensation, the folks here in Oregon are earning between $100,000 a year and $130,000 a year. The average length of service with Tektronix is a little over 17 years, so it's a pretty deep talent base here in Oregon. Since Tektronix was founded in 1946, the company's actually been provided over 2,700 U.S. patents, which is a prima facie evidence that you're doing qualifying research. Each year, we submit over 50 U.S. patent applications. Most of those are granted and patents are issued. The Vitality Index, which I previously mentioned, over 65%. And our worldwide investment in R&D, 12 to 18% of sales. So it's a pretty significant number. We generate both federal and Oregon research credits. These credits are predominantly based on the wages that we're paying the full-time engineers, as well as a percentage of the costs that are incurred with respect to the contractors who are performing qualifying R&D. Those credits, of course, reduce the cash taxes that we pay for federal and Oregon income taxes. Those enhanced cash flow benefits are put back into the business in the form of additional R&D, additional headcount, expanding the budgets of other departments. And since Tektronix has been acquired by Danaher in November of 2007, we have actually used some of those cash flow benefits, as well as some of the benefits from the borrowing ability of our parent company, to ourselves acquire seven new businesses, many of whom have, of course, now touches with Oregon. We believe, I think the whole coalition here believes, and folks that couldn't be here that are members of our coalition believe that, you know, the research credit attracts companies to Oregon. It also retains companies here. And we see it as sort of part of a suite of tax policy that a legislature and a group such as yourself can create that basically says that Oregon is open for business. We want to attract the right types of technologies to come to Oregon, to our state. And we believe that by attracting the right type of business here, that business will expand over time and it will create additional opportunities for tax receipts in the state. And I wanted to bring something, and I did, which I think symbolizes that. I know this is sort of a visual aid for you guys, but maybe some of you have seen this poster. I don't know, but this came out a few years ago. It's been enhanced, but it is the picture. It's called Silicon Forest Universe 2.0, and this is high tech in Oregon, starting with the universe of Tektronix here, the companies that we have spawned over time, Intel over here as another universe, ESI over here as another universe. There are 894 companies and organizations that are listed on this chart, which is circa 2008. So the research credit didn't bring these companies here. The single sales factor didn't bring them here, but it's creating the landscape that allows for the universe to expand, in our opinion. And we want this poster to be three times the size in 10 years, and we think it can be. So you're more than welcome to look at this if you have time before 10:15.
Thank you. Can you tell us how Tektronix uses the tax credit?
Right. In my testimony, I explained that the credit is used to generate additional cash receipts. We're paying lower income taxes. Those cash receipts are plowed back into our business in the form of additional R&D expenditures, added headcount, as well as expanding the budgets of other groups and saving enough in order to buy other companies, of which we bought seven.
So basically any tax credit would do the
same
thing?
Yes, it would.
And you said that you're you do have to do R&D or you wouldn't be competitive.
It's true. We have to do it.
And so if the tax credit went away, would you do R&D somewhere else in another state, or how would you respond to that if it went away?
The call is not mine, although I do get question from the executive group at Tektronix. It's absolutely true that we would continue to do R&D because we would have to. The question is, would we continue to do it to the extent we do it now in Oregon? I don't know the answer to that. It would sort of depend on where can we find the pockets of people who can do the work. And this is an area that's becoming, you know, more and more mobile as we have, you know, tools at our disposal. It would certainly be possible to do it in another state or take it offshore to, say, in India or China, if we could find the right capabilities.
So to your knowledge, is there another state that offers a better tax credit than this one?
There are other states that offer better credit incentives. I don't have my list in front of me.
And you know, the other question we have is, you know, with you've pointed out that you've been taken over by a much larger company that operates throughout the country. How do we know that the Oregon tax credit isn't being used just to improve the bottom line of an out-of-Oregon company?
Improve the bottom line. Well, credits certainly reduce tax expense, which then helps with net income on your financial statements. You know, everybody's trying to use, I think, the credits to the extent they can. I mean, the reality is that we, like I said, we have to perform this qualifying research someplace. The question is, where do you locate it? And, you know, we're predominantly in Oregon right now, being a homegrown industry. We're doing it here. But, again, I can't say with assurance that if the credit were to go away, that wouldn't be done someplace else.
Okay. Other questions from the committee? Representative Brewer.
Thank you. I am so glad you're here because I love another tax professional. So I have one question, though. Familiar with the federal R&D credit calculation, I am less familiar with the Oregon credit R&D credit calculation, and I'm a little bit uncertain as to the increased Oregon sales factor in here. How does that figure in? If I've got it correctly, you are basically, for Oregon, we're replicating the federal R&D credit calculation, but rather than giving 13 or 20% as federal gives it, we're only allowing 5% for federal purposes, or excuse me, for Oregon purposes. But where does the sales portion come in on this? Not the sales apportionment, but the sales, the increase in Oregon sales.
Yeah, there's in the law, there's actually an alternative calculation to the credit, which is based on R&D expenses, I believe, that are in excess of 10% of Oregon sales. So depending on what your Oregon sales would be, that's the numerator of your apportionment factor. If you're qualifying R&D spent in-state, right, it has to be in-state in Oregon, exceeds 10% of your Oregon sales, then you are also eligible under this alternative calculation for a 5% research credit not to exceed $2 million per year.
Thank you.
Other questions? Thank you. We'll move on to our next witness.
Madam Chair, co-chairs, committee members, my name is Donna Reagan. I'm the Director of Tax and Government Affairs for Triquin Semiconductor. We're located in Hillsboro, Oregon, and we are a spinoff of Tektronix 25 years ago. So thank you, Tektronix. We have had very tough times for many years, and thanks to the smartphone, we are doing very well. We are approximately 1,000 employees in the state of Oregon out of our 2,800 employees worldwide. We're a global-based company with headquarters in Portland, actually Hillsboro, and we have major facilities, major other manufacturing facilities in Texas, Florida, Costa Rica, in Oregon. In addition, we have what we call design centers, which are our bread and butter. We are an engineering firm. We depend on an 18-month transition on mobile device new product designs. 18 months. We have to come up with a new product every within that time frame. We have other areas that we also deal with in defense and aerospace, foundry business, and networks. And those life cycles are a little longer. Mostly networks is approximately 3 years. So within those design centers, what we look for are the employees. Who has radio frequency, which is our product line, that who can design radio frequency? It's very rare, very hard to find. And so what we do is we couple up with universities in those jurisdictions to try and mentor students in those universities. In addition, we actually go in and look for incentives with the state to market employees in that location. So we have set up design centers in Massachusetts, in North Carolina, Florida, Texas, Oregon, and California through acquisitions. In addition, we're also expanding overseas. Now, this is a very critical point because I could tell you all the great things about the state of Oregon and why we love it here and why we want to grow here. And as a matter of fact, we've spent over $75 million in expansion in the last year and a half and intend to continue to grow. But we're at capacity here. So what we look for are incentives, programs that we can partner with. And what we're asking the state of Oregon is to pass this so that we not only as our company, but as future companies, can be competitive with other states so we can bring the companies here and the employee base here that will then enhance the university systems and also the employees that are educated in our field. So I believe it's cyclical in that we need incentives to bring businesses, to grow businesses in the state of Oregon to be competitive with other jurisdictions. Often we get contacted by economic development from foreign countries, from China, Malaysia, Philippines, Singapore, as well as other states that are always trying to market us and take us away. We have that same example with the predecessor of Columbia Steel. They're moving their headquarters to Chicago. So we just need to stay competitive, and that's why I think this bill will help us if it's passed. Thank you.
How does your company use the tax credit?
We, like I said, we have had tough times. So right now we will be paying the tax and offsetting the credit against our taxes. And those funds that we've used will go back into continuing to hire the employees within the state of Oregon, as well as pay for the expansion, not only in the R&D area, but also in the facilities.
Okay, so any tax credit would do the same?
Fortunately, that is the case, but those other tax credits are specific to those states. They do not help the state of Oregon.
What tax credits are you referring to?
If I have a tax credit in Massachusetts for my R&D there, I cannot use it against Oregon as vice versa.
Oh, I meant any tax credit, whether it's for R&D or not, any tax credit would do the same.
As long as it's an Oregon tax credit, but Oregon only has the R&D tax credit that we qualify for.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions from the committee? All right. Thank you.
Okay.
I think we're going to postpone this hearing. Everybody else who signed up is a regular around here. So we will take this up again. We will roll it over to our next on Thursday. So we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3174, and we are adjourned.